And we are up and running. So this is a review lesson of the study of Sefer Shmuel. This is spring 2017. Goodness gracious, that really quite something. And what we will do in this lesson, we'll go over the topics that you have on the review sheet. But before we do that, just want to give you some general guidelines, which some of you have been asking for now for a number of weeks about the test. So the way it works is like this. Firstly, you're doing this test on a Sunday. I do apologize again. Nothing to do with my arrangement, but just the way it worked out. So not the best way of spending a Sunday, I guess. But on the other hand, who knows? It's just the way you have to do. Sorry? No, I think it's 1 till 3. Very exciting. In terms of the actual test, there will be 6 questions on the paper, of which you have to answer 5. Now, please do not be heroic and answer 6, because what will happen to your 6th answer will be whatever color pen I have in my hand will be a nice line going right through the question. I'm not in any way going to spend time trying to juggle around answers or whatever. Just don't have the time for that. So please answer 5, and then come and sign away your name, and off you go, and that's it, you're done. So I want to make that absolutely clear. Just a couple of points about the actual test. You'll have an instruction, you'll see at the top of the test paper, which says to you that you can use a basic translation. I can't allow the Red Book, the Judaica Press book, into the test, but what I can allow is either a Mikraot Gedolot title in Hebrew, which is certainly available all around the building here, or a basic translation, JPS, Koran, or whatever, even the big green art scroll if you have it. Right, I don't mind you bringing that in. I'm not going to allow the art scroll commentary book. That's not acceptable. But if you have just the basic translation, the Bible, Tanakh, whatever they call it, that will also be acceptable. I'm suggesting bringing a text for the simple reason that if you answer questions using the text, not chunks of it, you know, just a phrase, a line, whatever it may be, then that will certainly make me a much happier person than if you do not use the text. As I know you want to make me a very happy man, I'm very excited for you to use the text. Meaning, and be more serious about it, the text shows that you are connected to the Sefer, you've actually got some sort of hold in the book, and there's nothing more precious really than that as a takeaway from learning a book like Shmuel Bet, is that you'll have some familiarity, you'll show me you have familiarity with the word of the text, which is really important. Yeah.
If we have an English translation, can we quote in English?
Yes, and you can quote in English as well, I have no problem with that at all. That's good. There will be also, in terms of the test, I'm just trying to think what else. It's a two-hour test. I mean, all this stuff I think you know. And obviously try and be on time. Usually most people finish within an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half, but if you need the full time, it's no problem whatsoever. And those who have arrangement for extra time, that also is available. I think the proctor sits on this floor, if I'm not mistaken, and we can work that out at the end. In terms of sort of the basics of the questions, please note, I'm going to stress this because people have fallen down over this in the past. Every question is usually made up of at least 2, 3, sometimes 4 parts. Please do not answer a question without answering every part of every question. It sounds obvious, but when you're in a hurry or whatever, or if you've got a plane to catch, which I always tell a very sad story about that young lady about 12 years ago, she must be now married with children, I'm sure, decided that she was going to fly to Israel 2 hours after my exam was over. She booked a flight to Israel 5 o'clock in the evening, exam finished at 3. When she came into the room, she was very apologetic, but I said, how are you going to get to the airport by 3 when my exam finishes at 3? She hasn't quite thought it through. Finished the test in 20 minutes, really compromised her grade, which is really sad. I should have got an A, she ended up, I think, with a C. So please do not compromise yourself by sort of rushing or whatever. Take your time. There really is plenty of time to finish the test without any hassle. Okay, so this is what I'm trying to make it as hassle-free as possible. Yes, please.
You just mentioned that each question is going to have the A, B, C.
Yeah.
On the review guide, you just have
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to say is that, for instance, here you've got 12 topics. It's only 6 questions, so you might get 2 or 3 of these on one question. All right, if you see what I'm saying, 2 or 3 of these. Sorry.
So you might ask a question about Dhamma's relationship. They might say explain his relationship if you call him Ashoka.
Yep, and maybe something like that. You know what I like to do in the test is really to test 2 things. Number one is your basic knowledge, okay, which is what I suppose the test is really all about. And number 2 is really the fact that you're very intelligent young ladies, and I do accept that, and I'm very excited about that, and I want to get you to think a little bit. So when I ask a question which may say, what do you think, or what is your opinion, or compare and contrast, or whatever it may be, then please do what the question asks you to do. Sit there, have a little think, and whatever you want to say is perfectly acceptable, isn't it? And some of those questions, there's no right or wrong answer. I'm looking for sort of originality as much as possible. Okay, and I think when you see the paper, you'll see exactly what I mean when the questions come around. Yes?
Do you expect it to be an essay format, or is it bullet points?
Well, I would say bullet points probably not such a great idea, but paragraphs. Right, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the booklets and the paragraphs, because that's important. You get these delightful, at the moment I think they're blue covers, but sometimes they're pink, even white, depending on the sort of the feng shui was going on at the time. I don't know what to say about that. The reality of it is that those booklets, please do not hesitate to use as many as required. If you want to write on only one side of the page, please do that. Make sure you keep the margins, clear. Questions can be answered in any order. I don't mind if you do 1, 3, 5, 2 and 4, whatever order you want to do them in. Doesn't really bother me at all. But I do ask that the covers be reserved for just writing your name on the front and nothing on the inside covers, because people have tried that. I have one test I kept at home, which I thought was a really marvelous effort, though it really upset me at the time. Somebody had started the answer to the question on the back cover, the blue cover at the back of the booklet, the inside blue cover, and finished it literally with half a millimeter to spare on the outside of the blue cover. And that was really quite an amazing effort, but not really appreciated, because you could have taken another book. I know we're all into conservation, but at this point, these horrible little books are here. Let's use them as much as we need to. Even if you have one more sentence to write, take a second book. Don't hesitate. Okay? And make clear, obviously, what you're doing in terms of your questions, A, B, C, and D. It may be, and I usually don't encourage it, but if you feel that you want to answer the whole question in just one shot, as opposed to A, B, C, and D, dividing it up, you can do that, but make it absolutely clear, like in a bracket, say, this answers section A, this answers section B, etc. Make it clear what you are doing. All right? So it's really up to you, but generally speaking, easier if you go according to the the letters that are there. You answer A, then section B, etc., etc. Yes? Great question. The source is what I expect, and this is not how I answer the question if I was giving an MA course. An MA course, I expect you to know who said what. In an undergrad course, I would want you to say what was said. Not really concerned whether you remember it's Rashi or Radak or whatever, Rabbi this or Rabbi that. If you do remember, that's great, right? I don't find that a problem, but you're not required at this stage to remember exactly who said what, but the idea is really important. If you remember that there is a concept, right, but you're not sure, was it Rashi who said it, or was it this Rav, or whatever, whoever said it, don't worry about that. You can always say, some rabbi said this, or whatever. My uncle told me, or something like that. I don't know, whatever you want to say, but don't sort of get too creative on that one. It's not necessary to remember the name. Okay, so I'll leave it at that. In terms of pens, I always get great joy out of mentioning. Some of you heard this little diatribe before. Black or blue is perfectly acceptable. Yellow, pink, or any other color which you may have in your vast collection of pens is really not so acceptable. Okay, somebody once wrote an answer for me in a color which I could only read in the dark. Couldn't read it in the light. Quite amazing. It was to the point where literally I had to take it under the bed covers, that's as bad as it got, to try and read the thing. It's a funny story, but it really is true. And I would ask you, please do not be that kind of disconnected. Please make sure you've got, if it's a pencil, it doesn't matter, but ideally a black or a blue pen, and if you bring a spare, even better. Okay, just a very simple instruction, but it has to be set. Any other comments here on what I've said so far? In terms of trying to think what else I was... there was something else that I was going to say in terms of the actual rundown of the test, but it slipped my mind. It'll probably come to me in a few minutes. As I said before, it's a two-hour test, so, you know, don't be in a rush. Try and write clearly. Try and write. I know some people's writing is better than others. That's the way it is. But make sure, you know, you write with a clarity. And I know some of you have various dispensations. You know, we obviously can work that one out accordingly. I think one or two of you do it on the computer. But generally, the tests do come in pretty good condition. But really important, don't miss out any sections of the test. If you've done 3 out of 4 sections and it's 20 points per question, I can only give you 15 points. Can't give you 20 if you only do 3 sections out of 4 on a question. It's just impossible to go above what you give me. Okay, and I want to make that absolutely clear. It's really, really important. Alright, now in terms of questions on the test or before the test, don't hesitate. You've all got my email address, and please, if you have during revision time some sort of question that comes up, you're not quite sure what it means or what's going on, don't hesitate, ribshaff@aol.com. Send me a short email, just again, I am, your name, class, and the question that you have, and the promise is Bli Neder to get back to you within 24 hours. That's what I usually try to do. Any questions on what we've just said? This is like the general spiel. Okay? I think it's pretty clear, a lot of common sense, hopefully, in this whole story. Okay, in which case, let's hit the review sheet and see how we go. There's a lot of stuff to go through here. Maybe some of you can sort of chip in here a little bit and help me out. Number one, and Shmuel Bet, by the way, I think of all the Svarim that I teach, to do this in one semester probably is about the craziest thing that one can take on. It's a really complicated sefer in many ways. But at the same time, when you've achieved it, you can make a siyum on the sefer at the end of a semester. That is really, you know, worthwhile. I'm really excited about that. And if I forget to thank everybody for contributing, I'm saying it now, because I usually get at the end, I usually have to do it in a rush. Mikom alumni sculpting, and I really learn. You'd be amazed how much more I learn from you than I hope you're learning something from me, but I really do learn a lot from you guys, and it's always, always appreciated. The story of the Amalekite boy, this is number one. And the Amalekite boy is chapter one, and of course the whole question is about, two issues. Number one, is the story that he brings to David, right? He comes to David HaMelech, and he says to David, in no uncertain terms, that he is responsible for the death of Shaul, all right? And he claims that he finished the king off, and obviously he's looking for some sort of kudos from the king. And what happens as a result? What's David's reaction to the whole thing? Somebody remind me here. What does David do? Yep.
So first, his literal reaction is he tears Kriya.
Yeah.
And he's like upset, and Bnei Israel, and they fast, and then he says to him, you know, like, how could you, you know, command, tell someone from Hashem?
Yeah. Correct.
And he goes further, and
what does he actually do with the young man in the end? That's the worst part of the story.
He has a Na'ar kill him.
Yeah, yeah, and he gets one of his lads to kill him.
And the question, but then there's a point where he asks him about who he is, and he says that his father was a Amalekite who converted.
Right.
And the question is, he's like, did, you know, Malchavi wasn't king yet? Did he have the right to kill him? But there's an opinion that says that since we don't know, since we don't consider Amalekim converts, that by the fact that he was an Amalekite,
right,
he had the, it was totally fine for him to...
It was permission to do so under the law of, we have a commandment to fight and kill Amalek.
Yeah. The question is, does
In this sense, yeah, that would be the general answer that you would give, is that David considered this young man as a rebel against the original king, Shaul, by killing him, and therefore deserved to be punished accordingly.
Right.
The only real issue of the chapter is comparing it to chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph. Chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph says that Shaul committed suicide. Right? It says quite clearly that Shaul fell on his own sword. So, of course, the question then is, what is the truth? Is the story of the Amalekite boy true, that he finished the king, he says he pushed the sword? Or is it that the king killed himself, and this Amalekite maybe was just watching, the convert, the young man was watching, and when he saw what happened, he thought this is the way to get into the good books of David, and he ran off to find David and tell him what happened. But in reality, he wasn't telling the truth, because he was not responsible for killing the king. The king killed himself. So there's a very interesting discrepancy between different Mefarshim, and some say that in fact the two stories do link up, right, in the sense that in chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph, it says, you read it there very carefully, you'll see the young man started the process of killing the king, or if I'm not mistaken, I've forgotten how it goes over there, but you look in chapter 31, you'll see exactly what he says. And it could very well be that the story of the Amalekite boy is kind of a variation on the theme. Yeah, the king killed himself, but it could be explained in the same way that this young man in chapter 1 of Shmuel Bet is the same young man mentioned in chapter 31 of Shmuel Aleph, but obviously he's giving a slightly different version of the event in order to gain more credit with the king. The other option is that he's not responsible for the death of the king at all, but he's actually telling a lie. He witnessed what he saw, or he heard about it. Some say it was just by default he heard about it, but he didn't actually carry out the death sentence, and he went to David with the hope that David would reward him. And of course it worked quite against him in the opposite direction. He didn't understand that David's relationship to Shaul was a total commitment to Shaul. And of course, when you learn Shmuel Aleph, you'll realize how amazing that is, when Shaul spent most of his time trying to kill David, because he considered David a rebel. And David's attitude to Shaul was that this man is the chosen one, the anointed one of God. Bechir Hashem, the expression is, the chosen one of Hashem. So all of this is rolled into, number one, the story of the Amalekite boy. Essentially, as we said, sort of focusing on the comparison between chapter 1 of Shmuel Bet and the previous chapter, the end of Shmuel Aleph. Okay, any questions, any comments? I hope all of this is pretty clear. Yes?
Was it okay for him to be a convert from Amalek?
Well, that's again a very serious question, and that's one of the suggestions why David felt he could bring the death sentence against him, because of the fact that he comes from this dubious background. Correct. That was the main thing. But there is this background suggestion that David could have also felt, you know, I can be harsh with him because of who he is.
Okay.
Right? Because he sort of brazenly comes and announces maybe to David, here I am, a convert of an Amalekite, and I did what I did.
But in general, it's okay to be a convert?
Well, it's a great question, and the answer is probably not.
Okay.
Right? And there is this kind of, we mentioned this kind of very strange irony here, right? That it's an Amalekite boy claiming to kill Shaul. Shaul's failure was all based on the story with Amalek. All right? So that in itself sort of suggests that there is a kind of connection here, a deeper connection between the Amalekite convert and the king. And probably David realizes it and understands that instead of rewarding this young man, he's got to punish him. Okay?
He
makes it worse because he was a convert, definitely. Some say it was also that it was Doege Domi, and we did mention that, I think, or maybe we didn't, I don't want to confuse you. They want to suggest that this young man was in fact a completely different character, but that's very midrashic and I don't want to go there. Just in case you come across it in your reading, don't be surprised to find that. You know, whenever you get something like this, there's always sort of a whole range of views about who the players really are. Okay, we get that. It's quite normal. Number two, getting through it. The background to Avner ben Ner. Firstly, his relationship to King Shaul. He was King Shaul's Uncle, excellent. The Uncle Abner, as I would call him. Wasn't there a character on TV, Uncle Abner or something like that? Little Abner. No, not Uncle Abner, Little Abner. Uncle Abner, very powerful individual. Avner ben Ner. Actually buried in Hebron. Interesting, you can actually go, if you ever make a trip to Hebron, tomorrow to Machpelah, there is another Ma'ara to go and said to Davenin, which is the Ma'ara of Avner ben Ner. Okay, really one of the unsung heroes of the Jewish people, no question in my mind. What is the story about Avner ben Ner? Ner ben Ner is the supporter of Shaul. Shaul is dead. So who is going to take over? Does he have a progeny, a son that can become the king? Right? Avner is still loyal to Shaul. He's Shaul's uncle. He was very much the head of the army, the head of the Sanhedrin. Very, very powerful individual. Political person. So who is around? What is the guy's name? Who can possibly become the new king? Ish-boshet, right? They've all got this title, Boshet, which is really sad. Boshet means shame. Okay, so there's obviously some sort of background there. I think we did speak about it. Look in your notes. I remember now we explained about the title Boshet.
Didn't we say that he brings others?
Maybe he brings others to the right because of his great righteousness. Ish-boshet, it says about him, David said about him, he was a tzaddik. And if David said he was a tzaddik, then you can know this guy was a tzaddik. So there is something to be said about the story that Avner decides that Ish-boshet should become the new king. He's the kingmaker. Okay, in every situation, in every political situation, there are always some very powerful people behind the throne, behind the leadership. People of great wealth, sometimes people of great influence, usually a combination of the both. You see this in every political circumstance right through to the present day. I didn't examine the French election, but I'm pretty sure there was some powerful support for the guy who got in on Sunday, who doesn't seem to have very much political experience at all. It seems to be now becoming a theme around the world. Elect somebody who's got no experience as being the head of a government. Amazing. What a world we live in. Avner, of course, is very challenged by the fact that David is still sort of available and, you know, becoming more powerful. And there is this famous fight in Givon. Right? What happened? 12 of each group. 12 of Avner's group, and who's the other guy? David's nephew, a guy called Yoav. Interesting that they both have the word Av in their names. Alright, so these are, you would say, I don't know, I'm going to use the French word, patron. Right, these are not just gentlemen of great power, but they're kind of, you know, the godfathers, if you want to call them that. I'm not quite sure how to translate it. Interesting thing, just occurred to me that the word Av is there with Yoav and Avner. Okay, but what happens is that these young men have this, initially it was meant to be a game, a sport, and what happens to the 24 players, what eventually happens to them? Somebody help me out here, you'll get killed, right? They kill each other 12 and 12, it's a complete tragedy. Now the suggestion is that Avner was hoping that whoever wins this particular struggle, Min HaShemayim, would be a siman, it would be a sign that that group is the group to lead the country, right? I think we explained it in that particular way. But of course it became a complete mess because the 12 and 12 young men, 12 on one side, 12 on the other side, instead of wrestling each other and sort of just trying to overcome, they started taking out their swords and it became, unfortunately, a very bad scene. They all got killed. And of course at this point Avner has to run away. Avner is made to go into exile, and who starts chasing him? Got to remember this story because it's really important. Right? There are three brothers. Yoav has a brother called Avishai and another brother called
Asael.
Excellent. Asael. Okay, read through the chapter, read through the work, and you'll see exactly what's going on. Asael is very fast on his feet. He's a good runner. So he is chasing Avner because he wants to capture him on behalf of the army, the troops of David. Obviously, if he kills Avner, then David is established as the king without any opposition. What they'll do with Ish-boshet, they'll have to decide later. But, of course, what happens is that Avner is very experienced. He's a man of war. And when Asael reaches him, and tries to capture him. Avner is facing away from him, but his sword is by his side. As Asael approaches, Avner pushes his sword backwards. That's the way it was described. And he kills Asael with one blow to the fifth rib. Fifth rib is somewhere around your heart. A sword in the heart, not really going to do much more than probably kill anybody. This is the way it was. So of course, Avner now becomes very much public enemy number one for the family of Asael. Yoav particularly is frothing against this man, and as we know later on, it becomes an issue. So we're talking at the moment, number two, about chapter two. And that's the way it stays at that point. And obviously if we go to chapter three and chapter four, eventually, as we know, Avner is cornered by Yoav, but only after he switches sides. Avner decides that the rebellion against David is falling apart, and it has no merit, and he goes over to David's camp. And Yoav is very skeptical, as it were. David accepts Avner because he realizes... Yes.
When did Avner come back?
When did it come back from where? He's basically got to a place, I don't remember now all the places they were at. What has happened is that he is now with Ish-bosheth. He doesn't come back necessarily. I think Ish-bosheth, if I'm not mistaken, was in Yerushalayim. Or somewhere like that. I don't remember now. Sorry?
You said Avner's quartered by Yoav.
Yeah, no, that's later. We haven't come to that. That's later on.
Avner asks for a peace treaty.
Yeah. Correct, and of course what happens is that by Avner switching, that should have ended any sense of a civil war. And it doesn't work, because Yoav is very skeptical of what Avner does, and at the first opportunity, which is around chapter 3 at the end, you'll see that Yoav kills Avner on the pretext of a halachic discussion. Right? This is a very rabbinic explanation. They were talking about the law of chalitza. Law of Chalitza is when you take off the shoe, the woman has to marry the brother, and she refuses to do so. You know, when the husband dies, she marries her brother-in-law, but she refuses. It's called the law of Yibum, or Chalitza, the law of the Torah. And Avner is asked a question, a she'ela, by Yoav. How do you remove the shoe if you don't have any arms? How do you do it with your teeth? So Avner is giving a demonstration. He bends over for 1 second in order to demonstrate. Only the rabbis could invent a scenario like this. And in the process, Yoav takes his sword, and he plunges it into Avner's fifth rib, and Avner is dead. Midah keneged midah. As far as Yoav is concerned, he has done what we call the vengeance, Goel Hadam. He's avenged his brother's death. Okay, and this is, again, a very difficult item to sort of come to terms with. Yes, very quickly.
When they had a fight, it was in Givon, you said?
I don't remember. They fought in Givon.
And who won that?
At that point, nobody really won. It was a complete stalemate. Avner had to run away because David's group was obviously a bigger group. Avner realized that by trying to bring Ish-bosheth into power, he was fighting a losing battle. So initially, he had to save his own skin, and he ran away. Because after the fight with the 12 boys, the whole country was geared against the group represented by Avner. You'll see where it says that it became like a civil war. And Avner was running away for his life. It's, you know, when it comes to these sort of political situations, very, very complicated. And Avner, the tragedy was that although he meant the Shem Shemayim, but it certainly wasn't appreciated by David's followers, and they took, again, a very extreme measure. They didn't stand for any compromises here, which is really unbelievable. Yes, very quickly, Isma.
Just in terms of information, do we have to also know about the aftermath and the drama that happened between Devi not wanting everyone to think that he orchestrated the death of Avner?
I tell you something that might come in later on, because there's a question about Yoav. There has to be a question about Yoav.
Oh, okay.
So that would come into the question of Yoav, the relationship between David and Yoav.
Perfect.
All right, and that's where that whole discussion becomes relevant, because all the way through the Sefer, there's going to obviously be very serious discussion about, you know, hot and cold.
Perfect.
Very hot in one minute, very cold the next. So we'll come back to that. In chapter 4, just to add the footnote, Ishbosheth is assassinated by two gentlemen. The suggestion is that they were Givonim. Those who remember the chapter later on where David gives up the descendants of Shaul to Givon, in chapter 21, it makes sense that the people who are holding a grudge against the family of Shaul would be Givonim. So that's kind of an interesting suggestion, that those two gentlemen in chapter 4, Rechev, I think his name was in Ba'ana, two assassins go and kill Ishbosheth. They murder him in his bed. Very, very unpleasant. And again, hope that David will reward them. And of course, David immediately does what he did with the Amalekite boy and puts them to death. Okay, they have done an act of treason against the family of Shaul. Sorry? These two assassins. Chapter 4 of the Sefer. As we go through it, I'll just sort of illustrate where we're reading here. So again, number 2 that we've just done is essentially from chapter 2 through chapter 4. Okay, if you want to add that on the page, that's worthwhile. Number 3, and I'm sorry, I'm sort of moving through this because we won't get through it. David and Micha, chapter 5 and 6. Their relationship. Okay, so how are we going to describe their relationship? Maybe even in one word. Hot, warm, cold, freezing. They don't really have a relationship. The sad thing is, they did, and then it went off the boil very, very badly. Okay, if you remember the whole story, when David ran away from Shaul, back in Shmuel Aleph, what happened was that Michal was given over to Palti ben Laish, who, according to Chazal, never ever married her, never consummated the marriage with her. As many stories about the way that they conducted their relationship, and the reality was, in the end, David wanted her back, and she agrees to come back to David. Okay, a lot of discussion about her situation. Sorry,
who was she going to
have? A guy called Palti ben Laish, Palti or Pei Lamed Tet Yud, Palti ben Laish. You want to see that? Chapter 25 of Shmuel Aleph. Right at the end. We looked at it a little bit. And as a result, of course, Michal comes back to David and is promptly horrified by an event which takes place in chapter 6. David has already conquered Yerushalayim, but what does he have to do to make Jerusalem really holy? He wants to bring the Aron HaKodesh to Yerushalayim. Excellent. And what does he do when the Aron HaKodesh comes to Yerushalayim? Right? Is it a very solemn moment? Or is it a very unrestrained moment of joy for King David? You can even guess the answer to what I just said, right? Somebody here, help me out here. What sort of what? Sorry?
Ecstatic.
He was totally ecstatic. He was completely crazed with the spiritual moment. And he starts dancing around to the point where he sort of flings off his jacket and his shirt and whatever else, not quite getting down to the buff, but almost. And what happens is that Michal is watching, and to put it very bluntly, as the Queen of England would have said, this is not fitting for royalty. Okay, this is not the way we behave. Capital W. And basically what happened was that Michal, we tried to explain, she came from a very purposed home, focused on the being the first king and understanding the responsibility of being a monarch, etc. All of the heavy side of what goes with being the king. And when she saw David behave in such a frivolous way, she thought it was frivolous because he looked as if he was kind of drunk almost, she just couldn't handle it. And there is obviously a disconnect between David and Michal at that point. The minor issue, which wasn't so minor, but we did mention, was what happened to the Oron on its way to Yerushalayim. Somebody help me out here. What did it do? It almost
Uzzah. Uzzah tried to stop it from falling, and he died.
And again, we had a whole discussion, why would he die if he's doing such a noble thing? And the answer is because, again, the Oron was dangerous. The Oron was like something radioactive. You know, you don't go near it. Okay, and if you didn't treat it with the respect that was due, it would be very bad for you. If you looked at it when it was uncovered, or you know, anything like that, because it contained such an essence of holiness. So Uzzah One of the arguments is that they sent the Aron to Yerushalayim on a wagon. It should have been carried by the Levim, who were responsible to carry the Aron. They weren't there. And as a consequence, when it started falling off the wagon, Uzzah put his hand up to stop it falling. He was punished accordingly, even though it seems very severe. It's an example very similar to the story of the sons of Aaron. They come to the opening of the Beit HaMikdash, the Mishkan, and they bring Esh Zara, it says, we read it last week, 2 weeks ago, the story of the sons of Aaron, and in the process of doing something which was wrong, wasn't commanded by Hashem, they were essentially punished by death. And in the midst of all the celebration, there was a tremendous negative event that took place with a very powerful message to Am Yisrael. You do things when it is Tzivui Hashem, when God has commanded. Very difficult stories. The whole of Shmuel Bet is very difficult stories, yeah. The two people of Aaron, back in Parshat Shmini. Read that a few weeks ago. Yeah. And it's a similar story with Uzzah. I think I gave you a piece from the Nechama Leavitz, if I'm not mistaken, gave you something, a handout which is worth reading through just to get some background on that. Alright, so that's David and Michal. Not happy in the end. It says Michal never had children. Later on we see that she actually adopted children. She looked after children from one of her co-wives, if I'm not mistaken. We said that right at the end, but in terms of having her own children from David, after this particular fallout with David, it never happened again. That means basically they didn't live together as husband and wife again. David had six wives. You've got all that on that sheet. Remember all those names and the various players that you have that list of. We'll come to that in a second. And at this point, Michal, I suppose you would argue, extremely tragic, extremely sad. Someone who was very noble, someone who was very aware of her position, but really did not understand David. Okay, the Shadchan did not get it right. Okay, just matched up two very different people. Look, you know, both on the same track as far as the Shadchan was concerned, but not really on the same track at all. Very, very different. Any questions about that? Because otherwise I'm moving on. Okay. That's Adoni Michal again, chapter 5 and 6. Yoav and his interactions with David throughout the book. So this is not any specific chapter, but there are a number of chapters you can refer to. The whole issue of Yoav is again something which you need to think about, because it's pretty obvious there's going to be some sort of question on it. Oh, what I was going to say to you is that if you're listening carefully during this lesson, you should be able to have the whole list of questions and the exam in front of you by the time you leave the room. More or less, the subject. Not necessarily what the question is, but, you know, just an idea of what the test is going to be about. So listen carefully. The whole question of Yoav, interactions, that means that certain times they had positive interaction with the king, and on certain times it was very negative interaction. What was the most negative interaction between Yoav and King David? All right, to do with one of the other sons of David. Can't really make it more explicit than that. The famous rebellion of... I know Isabel knows it, but somebody else. Go on. Absalom. And what does the king command? Absalom should not be put to death. The rebellion has to be quashed. The rebellion has got to be put down. But Absalom should be spared. And who's the one who goes and kills him? Against the command of the king? Yoav. Yoav takes arrows and boom. And he kills Absalom when he's hanging by his hair. You know, he had the looks. He had the whole thing. The whole shtick going for him, and he was killed by Yoav. That's probably the lowest point of the relationship between the king and his nephew Yoav, David and Yoav. The high point of their relationship probably is earlier, when Yoav is trusted, for instance, in the story of Uriah. Even though it's not a very good mission that Yoav is on, he's so faithful to David, and David says, send Uriah out, put him in the front line, Uriah is sent by Yoav. There's no discussion. Earlier, of course, Yoav is supporting David against Avner, which you can argue is also maybe the positive relationship that he has with David. On the other hand, what does David say about the sons of Tzeruiah? His sister was called Tzeruiah, and three sons, Yoav, again, Avishai, and Asael, who was killed. What does David say about them? This would be a good quote. Okay, I think it's at the end of chapter 3, if I'm not mistaken. It's a great quote which says, is he enamored with his nephews? What does he say about them? One word that he uses regarding his nephews, right? Is he close to them? What word does he use? Because these are really strong, tough guys. All right, from the sons of Tzeruiah, what does David say? Let me quote it to you. I think it's the end of Perek Gimel. David says something quite shocking. Just see here. Yeah, it's the last verse in chapter 3. David says, "Anochi ayom racham Mashiach melech v'anashim ho'ele b'nei Tzeruiah." The men, the sons of Tzeruiah, koshim mimeni, are harder than me, are tougher than me. Yishalem Hashem lo se haro karato, may God give those who did evil according to his evil. He's talking about Yoav being responsible for killing Avner. So there's no question about it. David, and that's a good quote to remember, when he's talking about Yoav, he has this sense of fear. He has this sense that they are so powerful that they can, maybe in the end they can work against him. And of course, if you want to throw in a little tidbit, beginning of Book of Kings, the last rebellion against David is led by his son Adoniram, and who joins in against David? Finally, Yoav. So Yoav shows in the end that he is a rebel against David. And David says to Shlomo, I'm not going to be able to kill him, but Shlomo, you're responsible for making sure that Yoav is put to death. He's a rebel, that's his punishment. So in the end, I suppose you can argue Yoav gets the ultimate punishment from the king by being put to death. Yes, please.
Wait, can you go over the highest point in the relationship?
Yeah, the highest point again would be, what did we say? We said again in terms of his loyalty, looking about Uriah, making sure that he follows the orders of the king. And Yoav obviously goes and fights the wars of the king. Alright, that's chapter 10. You can read the whole thing there. Yoav is a very faithful soldier and general of the army. Okay, so from that point of view, Yoav is certainly very well connected to the king. But there comes a certain point in the story where Yoav's toughness becomes a challenge to David. David says, these guys are really kashim mimeni. They are really too much for me. They're too tough, right? And he's going to struggle with, particularly with Yoav, right to the end of the safe. There is a point later on, really towards the end, where Yoav is actually thrown out of being the head of the army. A guy comes in, Amasa ben Yeter takes over, and Yoav arranges for the death of Amasa ben Yeter pretty soon after that, and Yoav is reinstated. So Yoav, there's no question about it, there are question marks about Yoav. In what aspect did Yoav excel in a positive way? Nothing to do with armies or with fights. What are we told about him? We mentioned this, that says in the first chapter of Book of Malachim, he was a great Baal Chesed. He gave tremendous Chesed to people, had an open house. It describes his tent in the same way as the tent of Avraham Avinu, open on four sides. All right, and that means essentially anyone could come in at any time and find some sort of chesed, some sort of sustenance. So there's an interesting sort of mix of qualities here. Very tough army man, severe, but when it came to interacting with particularly people in need, he was someone who you could rely on to do chesed. So Yoav has his pluses and has his minuses. Okay, so definitely someone to have a bit of knowledge about. Any questions? We're moving on. Excellent. Number 5. Whoa, David and Bathsheba, some approaches to the story. Very quickly, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but please read on this very well. We said, in fact, there were 3 different levels at which we could approach the story. We said at a very basic, I called it kind of secular level, which is that David was, we bring David down to the level of just pure adultery and desire for this woman, etc., make it into a very primitive kind of desire that David had for Bathsheba. The other extreme, of course, we said, was that David was so elevated, and this is what we see all the time, that David was someone who was way above the average standard of behavior in terms of, particularly in terms of his relationship with God, that David was such a holy person that he saw in Bathsheba, he knew instinctively that this was going to be the mother of royalty. She was going to become the mother of Shlomo. So of course that David at that point, right, sort of is imbued with a spirit of holiness that he wants to bring this about as soon as possible. And the argument is, as we've pointed out, that David was too impetuous. He was too quick off the mark, as they say. The compromise between sort of all the positions is to say that in fact, according to Jewish law, David was not wrong. He had reasons why he could marry her. There was a suggestion that there was a bill of divorce which had been given by Uriah to his wife, or possibly that Uriah was not even in the process, he hadn't even properly consummated the marriage, some rabbis want to suggest, and therefore maybe they weren't considered to be a married couple anyway, or other halachic justifications for what David did. So Alpi Halacha, you can argue David was halachically covered in the sense that he's not going to be accused of doing anything wrong. But morally speaking, and this is where I think the real lesson of the story, David, in terms of his morality, was certainly lacking. And as soon as Nathan, in chapter 12, all I've said to you now was chapter 11, but chapter 12, the famous story of the lamb, taking the poor man's lamb instead of the rich person's lamb, is pointed out to David that his moral approach to the whole thing was lacking in the extreme. And as soon as David hears that, Chatati Aviti, he says, immediately I've sinned, how do I do tshuva? And if I said, I mentioned to you at the time, look at Tehillim chapter 51, and you'll see there quite clearly that David is under no illusion whatsoever that he committed a sin in the process. Now again, you'll say to me, but this is the process of bringing about Mashiach? And the answer is yes, but it doesn't always have to be absolutely pristine. We know that Mashiach comes about sometimes in the most strange and odd circumstances. Yehud and Tamar start the process, and that's again something which we know was very, very dubious, to put it mildly. So David and Bathsheba is a story which one can take on different levels. I always argue that the greatness of David was that in the midst of his humanity, he achieved this incredible closeness to God, but he had human qualities which we can relate to. Right? Once you make David into a Malach Hashem, into an angel, then how do you ever relate to such a person? And I think that's why the Torah reveals sometimes the mistakes that these great men make, in order to say, you know what, we can all learn from him. Because the human condition is all about learning from your mistakes. Not an approach that is accepted by some commentators. I think Rav Dessler, we pointed out, various other commentaries see it as on a higher level. You know, you can discuss it as best you can, but again, look at your notes to see what you've written about it, because this is obviously going to come up in the test. Any comments, any questions? Yes.
Who was the Nabi's name?
Nathan the prophet. Nat. Okay.
This is all in chapter 11?
This is chapter 11 and then chapter 12. So 11 and 12 go together. Okay. Number 6. I'm looking at the time and we may just get through this. Amnon and Tamar, what happened? Why and the ramifications? That's chapter 13. Yud Gimel, very unlucky, as we know. And the reality is it really was a terrible story. Amnon shows a tremendous lack of dignity towards Tamar. Remember that Tamar and Avshalom, a brother and sister, born from a mother who was a, what's the expression, Yifat Toar, a woman who was captured in war. And the rule of the Torah was that these women were allowed to be brought back by the soldiers. They would be kept at home for a month. The soldier was allowed to have one act of relations with the woman, and then the woman was forbidden to him for a whole month. And then if at the end of that month, when she's been crying to go home for a whole month and everything else, and all the cosmetics have gone and all the paint and everything else, all the clothing is not quite the way it was, then in 100, almost 99 out of 100 cases, the women were sent back. Right? In David's case, he taken a captive, a daughter of one of the princes Melech Geshur, I think it is, one of the princes from the north, outside Israel, he taken as a captive, and he had two children from her. One was called Avshalom, and the other one was called Tamar. So Tamar had a half-brother. The half-brother was called Amnon. Different mother, same father. And Amnon has a tremendous desire to essentially to rape her. He's a very unpleasant man. And as a consequence, with his friend's help, a guy called Yonadav, Amnon achieves what he wants to do, and then he throws her out of the room. Tamar is completely devastated. What is shocking there is, of course, the lack of reaction of David. It says David got very angry and didn't do anything. Okay, and this is kind of revealing to us that in the family circumstance, David may have been very lacking. We've suggested that in order to answer one of the questions later on as well. What exactly happened in terms of David with his children? His children seem to, sort of take almost a pride in rejecting him. What was going on? So maybe the expectations were not fulfilled. They expected David to be more supportive, and he maybe wasn't. We said also, because of this story with the Yifat Toar, which is kind of interesting, there were many of these women, and they had children that they conceived. And the women would go home, and they didn't want to take home their babies. The babies were conceived from the Jewish soldiers, and it was a shame for them to bring these babies home. They abandoned them. So who took in all of these babies? It says one of the places they were taken to was the palace of David. So David's palace became a bit like a home for abandoned children. And David spent a lot of his time, when he wasn't fighting wars, he was looking after these children. And the suggestion, therefore, is more time on the cause, less time on the family. And as I said, there are many, many examples of this right through to the present day. People are very much taken with their personal campaign in line, but you've got to find a balance. Yeah, give time to your shul, give time to your personal charity, whatever you want to do, your personal tzedakah, but also time for your family. When one overtakes the other, then it can be, how should we say, it can be challenging. Yes? They were abandoned and David took them in.
They were also his kids?
And together with his kids, but mainly not. All the soldiers would have brought home, who knows, maybe hundreds, we just don't know. We haven't got any clue. But the Midrash brings this as a reason why David's family rejected him. Every rebellion is from a son of David. It's remarkable, right? You've got a father who's an Ish Kodesh and everybody is going to try to kill him. It doesn't make sense. But it does. The family dynamic really needs to be thought about. No, that's the point. They're related through the father, but not through the mothers, right?
And
so what happened was that Tamar was the daughter of Yifat Toar, and Avshalom was her brother, also from the same mother. They were, but not Amnon. Amnon was from David, right? And then, of course, what happens is Avshalom gets very angry, bottles it up, which is not good. Don't bottle up your anger. And 2 years later, we're told that he takes revenge on Avshalom. Takes revenge on Amnon, taking him off to some sort of celebratory place that he took him to with the purpose of actually killing him, which is what he did. David is devastated, of course. One thing I just want to say, the ramification, Amnon, Tamar, the laws of Yichud, which we did speak about very briefly, just think about that, worth remembering, worth going over your notes, because the laws of Yichud have such a relevance in the 21st century, let alone in the 10th century BCE, it's even more relevant in the 21st century of the common era, that you have these laws which basically control the interaction between men and women who are not related by marriage or whatever, and these laws developed seemingly from the events of Amnon and Tamar. Had there been an awareness of the laws of Yichud, then this whole tragedy would never have taken place. So that's what I'm calling the ramification. Okay? Number 7, the rebellion of Avshalom. 4 chapters, lots of stuff to talk about. Chapters 15 through 19. Okay? And the players, you have a list of all the different players. Don't expect you to remember all of the names, but some of them just stick, eventually in your mind. But the events and the question of David's supporters. Why did the people go for Avshalom in the beginning? Because he was very personable. He greeted them when they came to Yerushalayim. He said, "Don't go to my father, come to me, you'll get a better deal." They came for judgments or whatever it may be. And he wowed the public with what politicians today do all the time, making promises. Okay, did he fulfill on the promises? That's the question, which is always the question for every election or political situation. As a consequence, eventually Avshalom decides, well, I've got to do the ultimate act of taking over from my father, because this is what he wanted. And as a consequence, he led a rebellion, which became very, very severe. The beginning of the rebellion, we know David left Yerushalayim. There's the episode of Shimi ben Gera, for instance, where he curses the king. Shimi is from the tribe of Binyamin, so he's got a lot of built-up resentment to David anyway. And various other people. And of course, in the end, the rebellion is put down. And not really, the consequence of it is not really satisfactory. We know that the men of Yehuda argue with the men of Israel about bringing David back to Yerushalayim. And there seems to be already a sense of disconnect between different groups in and amongst the Jewish people. Okay, so this is kind of a portent of things to come. So that's the rebellion, and again, obviously a lot more to say, but that's Bekitsa, what it's about. Number 8, the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, chapter 20, which is really important. How can a Jew be given over to save others? The approach of Rav Soloveitchik, again, you've got a handout about that. The whole question of deciding that someone deserved to die, normally that was the prerogative of the king. So why did this woman, some rabbis say, Serach bat Oshe, she must have been 500 years old, she says to the king that she'll give over Sheva, or I think to Yoav, she says, Sheva ben Bichri will be given over to you, provided that you stop sieging our city. And the next thing you know, the head of Sheva ben Bichri flies over the wall, and the rebellion is over. Sheva ben Bichri, again, from the tribe of Binyamin. There's still resentment in the ranks against David from the original members of the family, or the connected to the tribe of Saul. So as a consequence, that we ask the question, how could this woman decide that Sheva ben Bichri was deserving of punishment? And we said that normally that's the prerogative of the king, but the rebellion here wasn't just against personally against David, but against what David stood for. As we explained, it wasn't just against the leader of the party, it was against the whole platform, the whole raison d'etre of the party. And in this case, anyone who is affected by this, who wants to uphold the honor of Am Yisrael, or the tribe of David, was allowed in this circumstance to take Sheva ben Bichri and kill him, and end the rebellion. Okay, so again, if you haven't seen what I've spoken about, just check it. If you've got the red book, there's a little paragraph there in chapter 20 at the end explaining exactly how this worked. Okay, so Sheva ben Bichri, chapter 20. We're almost out of time. I'm going to try and get this done. Episode of Givonim, chapter 21, how and why. Terrible story. David had to give up 7 members of the family of Shaul. And remember, we explained that this goes right back to the early days of Yeshua. The Givonim were given rights, even though they didn't deserve it, but they were promised by Yeshua protection. And as a consequence, the rabbis explained that this was all built around the idea of Kiddush Hashem. Yeshua kept his promise, even though it was made falsely, because the Givonim had tricked the Jewish people, but they felt that they now had protection of the king. And in the episode of Nov, when David ran away to this city and the priests were killed, the suggestion is that some of the Givonim were killed as well. And the order was given by Shaul. So as a consequence of Shaul giving this order, the Givonim were very much against Shaul, as you mentioned before. And as a result, in chapter 21 of Shmuel Bet, they exact their revenge. The only thing at the end, the positive thing that comes out of it, is the way that the bodies are respected, Ritzpah Bataya. You see the whole story there. One of the concubines, I think it was, of Shaul, makes sure that the bodies are treated with kavod. Okay, they're respected. Number 10, the end of the Sefer, David's second major sin, which was, after Bathsheba was number 1, what was number 2? that he told Yoav, said, don't do it. Chapter 24, come, we read it last week. So Yoav told him, don't do this, said to Uncle David, don't do what you're about to do. What did he do?
Counting
the people. Right? Look at chapter 24, you'll see there's two things going on there. Number one, there's a terrible famine, and David goes and counts the soldiers, and the suggestion is that, you know, there's stuff going on there which should not have happened. David maybe did this for personal gain or personal preference or whatever, and as a consequence, Yoav points out to him that this was wrong. David says, Khatati, number twice he says it now, the second time, he admits that he did something wrong, and as a consequence, the famine ends, right? And it ends significantly at the point of the threshing floor, the Gorin Aravna. Aravna was a man who owned the piece of land where the temple was about to be built. So David saw this as a siman, a sign from Hashem, that this was the place where the temple was going to be built. He was desperate still to do as much as he could to prepare. And as a consequence, he buys the piece of land. Okay? And that's really the last story, Chapter 24 of Shmuel Bet. Yes, very quickly, yes.
Okay, just two confessions. The first is, I thought that the famine had to do with the fact that the two things related to the famine was the story of the Gibronim and also the lack of respect of bearing Shmuel.
Correct. And that's all part of it as well, which has to be mentioned. Right? Right. That's
so
true.
So then, what is the second? Can you just emphasize just a little bit more? Talk about the second sin and the buying of the, like, how.
Yeah, it seems it's strange, but when the admission of David is made, right, and the destruction stops, because David is given choices.
Right.
What do you want to happen as a punishment for what you did? So he says that there'll be there'll be pestilence in the land. So for 3 days, it says thousands of people died. Okay, it's pretty shocking.
But
the place where that plague stopped was on the actual mount, the temple mount, right? And that was a sign. He saw the angel of death got to that point and did not go from there, right? How David knew this, we don't know, but there's some sort of awareness he had. And as a consequence, that became the place which for David was a sign of the land that he should buy in order to secure the place to build the Beit HaMikdash, all right? Which really kicks into number 12. Why did he not build the first temple? And we said two answers. Number one, because he was a man of war, and a man of war doesn't build a temple of peace. And answer number two, which I think is really significant, is that he was too holy. What do I mean by too holy? He invests such a lot of holiness in the building. What happens? Correct, and that was unacceptable choice. I'm just finishing off number 12 because it ties in what we were just talking about, I'm just going to say number 11 because I'm really out of time. So that essentially the two basic reasons that may very well come into some sort of question about King David, because obviously that's one of the big issues about his desire to build the Beit HaMikdash. You can all quote Mizmor Shir Chanukata Bayit LeDavid. He already built, already wrote the opening psalm to open the temple. You know, he sort of played the music. He got it all together for the big event, but he wasn't allowed to do it. And that's again one of the ideas, that he was just too holy, too much holiness would have gone into the building. And the problem with that is that when God destroys eventually the building, it would not have been the building, but Chas v'Shalom, it might very well have been the nation of Israel instead. And it wasn't meant to be. Number 11, David, King David, his life, his trials, his strengths, his failures, and other salient points. That's essentially what we've been talking about this whole lesson. Okay, so if you get a general question about David, give examples of his strengths, okay, his tremendous sense of knowing when he's wrong, to admit that he's wrong, his tremendous sense of closeness to God, okay, he's recognizing God's kindness and chesed whenever he could, but at the same time, his failures and his weaknesses, the idea of being too impetuous, too quick, too premature in everything that he did, that worked against him, all right, particularly with the story of Bathsheba and the consequence of that, which again was really Again, very positive in certain ways, but certainly very negative in other ways. So now the section 11 here is really a kind of take your pick of various events in Shmuel Bet in order to answer any question of that kind of generic nature. I'm a bit out of breath. I apologize. I felt like I've just been in a race, and I got to the end of the race, but dragging along. It was a lot. This was kind of adventurous to do this all in an hour. We've literally looked and reviewed Sefer Shmuel Bet in less than an hour. It's pretty tough going. As I said, two things. Number one, please don't hesitate. If you have a question which needs further elaboration, don't hesitate. Send me an email. I will get back to you as soon as I can. And obviously, when it comes to, in terms of preparation for this, make sure that you know the storyline as best you can. Obviously, knowing the storyline is really the bottom line of everything. But so much of what we studied here, if you think about it, the analysis, I think, is really precious. And always, always, exams are what they are. What I'm always aiming for you is to come out of this and saying, wow, we really did learn something positive, something really important. I will now look at Tehillim a bit differently to the way I looked at it, because Tehillim is David talking from the heart. Tehillim 51, as I mentioned, he admits that he did a sin with Bathsheba, and he talks about it. Very amazing man. And also to sort of, you know, just be a bit more in the know about something which is so important, not just about King David, not just about the history of that period, but essentially who we are today. All right, without the strength and without the humility at the same time of a King David, how could we ever imagine that in 1948, and I always link it to this, Am Yisrael, in such a difficult situation, could say to the world, we're declaring the state of Israel, and now, this year, 70 years later, a few weeks' time, we're celebrating 50 years of Yerushalayim, which is obviously revolving around King David. It will do. It's so precious just to know a bit of the history that you can really celebrate, because you understand how important and how precious all of these places really are. Any final comments? I think I've worn myself out, but I hopefully haven't worn you guys out. Have a wonderful couple of days, weeks. I'm not sure when I see you. See you on Sunday the 21st, I guess. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much.